some people, eh? Proper turd nuggets.
At the foot of the stairs, a possibly Indian girl in an all-silver Tin Man costume reads my mind. Bathrooms this way. Turn right. Go along. It's there. Love the nail varnish, by the way. Peacock blue? I get stuck between saying yes and thanks, so it comes out yanks. Embarrassed, I follow her directions to a TV room where a bunch of guys are sitting on sofas watching The Exorcist. But I'm not staying for this. The Exorcist was on at the party in Malvern, where I lost my virginity to a temporary best friend's ex-boyfriend's friend called Piers. Not a memory I cherish. Isolde De La Hunte told the whole school about Oink Oink's big night, of course, and publicized what Piers had said about me afterwards. Now I'm in a blue-lit corridor, booming with Bjork's hyperballad. I pass a pair of tall doors and peer in. 30 or so people are dancing in a big sort of ex-ballroom, lit by dim orange lamps. Some of the dancers are wearing stripped-down half-costumes. Others are in only T-shirts or vests. I see Lance sliding his hand over his own torso and neck. He tosses his dandruffy mane, spots me at the door, and beckons me inside with a sex god's come-hither finger. I hurry off down the chilly corridor before I puke. Round a corner, up some stairs and down some more until I find a bay window with a view of what might be the front of Slade House with two big gateposts, though the streetlights and tree shadows and lines are blurred by mist and the fogged-up mullioned window. And to be honest, I left my sense of direction in the kitchen. Hyperballad has turned into Massive Attack Safe from Harm. Fern says my name. She's draped on a giant sofa in an alcove. French cigarette in one hand and a glass in the other, like she's doing a photo shoot. Hello. Are you enjoying the party? Yes, actually. Have you seen Todd? I've seen how besotted he is with you. I so badly want to hear this that I join her just for a moment. The leather sofa's cold. I sink deep into it. It makes that dry, squelchy noise like new snow or polystyrene that someone needs to invent a proper adjective for. Do you think so? Big time, Sal. It wasn't for paranormal experiences that Todd showed up tonight. When are you guys going to hook up? Tonight? I act cool, but I'm happier than I've been for ever, actually. That depends. These things have their own pace. Bollocks, girl. Fern's cigarette hisses in her glass. You set the pace. Todd's a keeper. Lovely guy, really. Reminds me of my brother. Fern's never mentioned a brother. Not that we've talked much. Is your brother a student? Or an actor? Or... He's not anything these days. He's dead. Oh, God. I'm famous for my big mouth, Fern. It's okay. It's fine. It happened, 5 Christmases ago. It's history. Fern stares at the body of her cigarette bobbing in her drink. I try to fix my blunder. Was it an accident? Or illness?
Suicide.
Johnny drove his car over the edge of a cliff. Bloody hell. I'm sorry. Why did he... I mean, no, forget it. It's not...
He didn't leave a note.
But the cliff was a field away from the road to Trevado, our ancestral pile near Truro, so we know it wasn't an accident. Fern acts a smile. He chose Daddy's vintage Aston Martin as his sarcophagus, too. The act was the suicide note, you might say. I didn't mean to probe, Fern. I'm sorry. I'm an idiot. Stop apologizing. Johnny was the idiot. Well, that's not fair. Daddy had died 2 years before, Mummy had gone to pieces, so Johnny was juggling the legal mess, the death duties, a degree at Cambridge, of course, and battling depression, unknown to us. His ideas about polka dots and honour, though, they really were idiotic. Utterly, utterly idiotic. We could have just sold off an acre or two. We watched the misted-up night through the misted-up window. That's why I joined Parasoc, if I'm honest, says Fern. If I could just see a ghost, just once. A Roman centurion, or a headless horseman, or Nathan and Rita Bishop. I'm not fussy. Just one ghost. So I know that death's not game over, but a door. A door with Johnny on the other side. Christ, sadly, I'd give anything to know he didn't just stop that stupid afternoon. Anything. Seriously. Like, Fern clicks her fingers. That. I unpeel my face off a big, cold leather sofa in a dark alcove. Safe from harm is still on, so I can't have slept long. Fern's gone, but sitting a foot away is a guy dressed in a furry brown dressing gown and not a lot else, judging by his hairy legs and hairy chest. Right. He's not eyeing me up. Actually, he's just staring at the blank wall. I thought there was a bay window there, but obviously not. The dressing gown man's not that old, but he's going bald. He has sleepless, owlish eyes and an almost monobrow. Do I know him? Don't see how. It's strange that Fern would just vanish like that, straight after spilling her guts about her brother. But that's actresses for you. Maybe she was pissed off that I nodded off. I ought to find her and put it right. Poor Fern. Her poor brother. People are masks, with masks under those masks, and masks under those, and down you go. Todd must be back in the kitchen by now, but the sofa won't let me get up. Excuse me, I asked Mr. Dressing Gown, but do you know the way to the kitchen? Mr. Dressing Gown acts like I'm not even there. I tell him, thanks, that's really helpful. His frown deepens, then in slow motion, he opens his mouth. Is it supposed to be funny? His voice is dry as dust, and he leaves big gaps between his words.
Am I still in the house?
Jesus, he's stoned out of his Easter egg. Well, it's not Trafalgar Square, I can promise you that. More seconds pass. He's still talking to the blank wall. It's bloody weird.
They took away my name.
I humour him. I'm sure you'll find it again in the morning. The man looks towards me, but not at me, as if he can't quite place where my words are coming from.
They don't even let you die properly.
So far, so Looney Tunes. Whatever you've been smoking, I'd steer clear of it in future. Seriously. He cocks his shaved head and squints, as if hearing words shouted from a long way off.
Are you the next?
I actually giggle. I can't help it. What, the next messiah? The sofa vibrates to the giant bass in Safe from Harm. Get a big strong black coffee, I tell Mr. Dressing Gown. The man flinches, as if my words were pebbles hitting his face. Now I feel bad about laughing at him. He screws up his red eyes like he's trying to remember something.
Guest,
he says, and blinks about him, Alzheimerishly. I wait for more, but there isn't any. Am I the next guest? Is that what you're asking? The next guest? When the man speaks again, he does this utterly incredible ventriloquist trick where he mouths his words a second or two before you hear them.
I found a weapon in the cracks.
His sound delay trick's amazing, but his mention of weapons triggers a warning light. Okay, thing is, I don't need a weapon, so... But from out of his dressing gown pocket, the sad, half-naked stoner produces a short silver spike, about 6 inches long. First I recoil in case it's a threat, but actually he's offering it to me, like a gift. The non-spiky ends decorated with a fox's head, silver, small but chunky, with jeweled eyes. It's lovely, I'm saying, twizzling it. It looks antique. Is it some kind of a geisha's hairpin or something? I'm alone on the leather sofa. Nobody's in the corridor. Nobody's anywhere. Mr. Dressing Gown's long gone, I sense, but I'm still holding his fox hairpin. God, I zoned out again. This isn't a good habit. Safe from harm has turned into the orb's little fluffy clouds. There was a blank wall here, I thought, but actually there's a small black iron door, exactly like the one in Slade Alley, only this one's already ajar. I go to it, crouch down, push it open, and peer out, just my head. It's an alley. It looks very like Slade Alley, but it can't be, because it can't be. My knees are still on the carpet, in Slade House. It's dark, with very high walls and no people. It's as quiet as the tomb, as they say. There's no little fluffy clouds out here. It's as if my head's passed through a soundproof membrane. About 50 meters away to my left, the alley turns right under a flickery street lamp. To my right, about the same distance away, there's another lamp, another corner. It can't be Slade Alley. I'm in a corridor in the house. 50, 80, 100 meters away. I'm no good with distances. So, drugs? Drugs. If one frickhead put hash into no hash brownies, another frickhead to the power of 10 could have sprinkled something trippier in the punch bowl. It happens. Two students Freya knew in Sydney went to Indonesia, ate some kind of stew with magic mushrooms in it, and thought they could swim home to Bondi Beach. One of them was rescued, but the body of the other was never found. What do you actually do if you find an impossible alleyway on an acid trip? Go down it? Could do. See if it takes me back to Westwood Road. But what about Todd? Waiting for me, right now, in the kitchen, wondering where I am. No. I'd rather get back. Or, what if Slade House is the hallucination and this door's my way back? Not a rabbit hole into Wonderland, but the rabbit hole home. What if someone touches my back and I jerk back inside, into the corridor in Slade House, to the music, to the party? Startled twice over to find the Wicked Witch of the West peering down. Hey, Sally Timms, you okay down there? You lost something? Hi. I search for her name. Kate? Are you feeling all right? Did you lose something? No, I was just wondering where this door led to. The witch looks a bit puzzled. What door? This door. And I show Kate Childs the blank wall, the doorless blank wall. I touch it, solid. I get up, wondering how I bluff this, trying to buy time. My thoughts revolve. Yes, I'm hallucinating. Yes, I ate or drank something with drugs in it. No, I can't handle telling Kate that someone's drugged me. Look, I'm sloping off home. But the night's still so young, Sally Timms. Sorry, it's this head cold. My period started. Kate removes her knobbly Wicked Witch mask to show an anxious sisterly face framed by Barbie blonde hair. Let me summon you a cab, then. It's a genuine magic power I was born with. Click of the fingers. She starts patting herself down like at airport security. I just happen to have an extremely handy state-of-the-art cell phone in one of these witchy pockets. A taxi would be nice, but I've only got £2. I'll walk. She looks dubious. Is that such a great idea if you are ill?
Positive. Thanks. The fresh air'll do me good.
The unmasked witch isn't sure. Why don't you ask Todd Cosgrove to get you home safe and sound? One of the last gentlemen in England is Todd.
I didn't know Kate knew Todd. Actually, I was just looking for him.
He's looking for you, too, Sally. Up in the games room.
Tonight feels like a board game co-designed by M.C. Escher on a bender and Stephen King in a fever.
Which way's the games room?
The quickest way is back through the TV room, down the hall, up the stairs and keep climbing. You can't go wrong.
Everyone's glued to the screen, the way people are when something major's happened. I ask a half-turned werewolf what's happened.
Some girl's been abducted, like.
The werewolf's a northerner. He doesn't look at me.
A student. A girl from our uni.
Jesus! Abducted?
Aye, that's what they're saying.
What's her name?
Polly. Or Sarah. Or...
The werewolf's drunk.
Annie. She's only been missing 5 days. But a personal item was found. So now the police are afraid it's like a real kidnapping. Or worse.
What kind of personal item?
A mirror,
mumbles the werewolf.
A makeup mirror.
Hang on. Look. The TV shows our student union building, where a female reporter's holding a big pink microphone.
Thank you, Bob. And here on the city campus tonight, the mood can best be described as grim and sober. Earlier today, the police issued an appeal for any information on the whereabouts of Sally Timms, an 18-year-old student last seen in the vicinity of Westwood Road on Saturday night.
The reporter's words all gloop together. Missing? 5 days? Since Saturday? It's still Saturday. I've only been in Slade House for an hour. It must be another Sally Timms. But a photo of my face fills the screen, and it's me. It's me. And the Sally Timms on the screen is wearing exactly what I'm wearing now. My ZZ Hikaru jacket and Freya's Maori jade necklace that arrived today. That I signed for at the Porter's Lodge only 12 hours ago. Who took that photo of me? When? How? The reporter thrusts her big pink microphone at Lance. Lance Arnott, who apparently is dancing in this building right now, while also speaking to a TV reporter 2 miles away, saying,
Yeah, I saw her just before she disappeared at the party and...
Lance's codfish lips keep moving, but my hearing kind of cuts out. I should be switching on the lights and shouting, No, people, look, there's been some stupid mistake. I'm Sally Timms, I'm here, it's okay. But I'm afraid of the fuss, the shame of being a spectacle, of being a news story, and I just can't. Meanwhile, Lance Arnott's making a doubtful face.
Afraid so, yeah. She had serious trouble adjusting to college life. Bit of a tragic figure, vulnerable, not very streetwise. Know what I'm saying? There were rumours of drug use, dodgy boyfriends, that kind of stuff.
Now I'm angry, as well as frightened and confused as hell. How dare Lance say all that about me on live TV? For not fancying him, I'm a tragic, vulnerable druggie. The reporter turns back to the camera.
A clear picture is emerging of the missing student as an unhappy girl, a loner, with weight issues. A girl who had trouble adjusting to real life after private schools in Singapore and Great Malvern. Following the discovery of her compact mirror in,
The reporter shuffles her notes.
Slade Alley, earlier today, the friends and relatives of Sally Timms, while still hoping for the best, must, as the hours go by, be fearing the worst. This is Jessica Killingly, reporting live for South Today. And back to you in the studio, Bob.
God knows what Freya, Mum and Dad must be thinking. Actually, I know what they're thinking. They're thinking I've been murdered. They urgently need to know I'm fine. The police need to call off the search. But I can't just announce it here.
I pull back from the werewolf and bang into a sideboard. My hand touches something rubbery, a Miss Piggy mask. Thanks to Isolde de la Hunte et al., I've got bad associations with pigs, but if I don't put it on, any second now someone will see me, point, and shriek, so I just loop its cord round my head and cover my face. Cool. A bit of breathing space. What was the reporter saying about my compact mirror? I used it in the kitchen after Todd left, didn't I? I check in my handbag. Gone. Normally, I'd retrace my steps and hunt it down, but I want to get out of Slade House even more than I want Freya's gift back. She'll understand. She'll have to. Todd'll know what to do. Todd's unflappable. We'll slip away and sort out what needs to be sorted. Him and me. At the foot of the stairs, a possibly Indian girl in an all-silver Tin Man costume says, "Did you hear about Sally Timms, the missing girl?" "Yes, I did." I try to get by, but she's blocking my path. "Did you know Sally Timms well?" asks the Tin Man girl. "Not very," I answer, and slip by up the stairs. The banister glides under my fingertips, and the hubbub of the hallway fades away, like I'm climbing into a fog of silence. The carpet on the stairs is cream like margarine. The walls are panelled and hung with portraits, and up ahead is a small square landing guarded by a grandfather clock. A pale carpet and an antique clock is asking for trouble in a student house, Erasmus scholars or not. The first picture shows a freckled girl. She's really lifelike. The next picture's of an old soldier with a waxed moustache, the sort who'd say, "Roger, Wilco, chocks away." I'm short of breath, but I can't have been climbing that long. I need to join a gym. Finally, I've reached the grandfather clock. Its face has no hands, only the words, "Time is, time was, time is not." Highly metaphysical, deeply useless. To my left's a door, panelled to match the walls. To my right, more stairs climb past more portraits to a pale door. Which is the games room? I knock on the panelled door. I hear only the clock's rusty, oiled heart. I knock again, but louder. Nothing. But the rhythmic grunt of cogs. Turn the doorknob, then. Open the door. Just an inch. Peer in. This room's igloo-shaped, lit by a bedside lamp, windowless, carpetless, and contains a large four-poster bed and not a lot else. The bed's maroon drapes are drawn. The mechanical grinding noise has stopped, but I call out softly, "Todd?" in case he's in the bed. "Todd? It's Sal." No reply, but if Todd ate a hash brownie, or actually a no-hash brownie, he might be asleep, snoring softly, maybe, in that bed, like Goldilocks. I'll just peep through the drape. That can't hurt. Anyway, I'm unrecognizable in my Miss Piggy mask. So I shuffle over the grainy floorboards and lift a flap of the velvet. Just an inch. "Miss Piggy!" booms a man. Axel. Sweat glazed in the blood-dim cocoon. And I only half-block a shriek. The bed's taken up by a grotesque frame of naked limbs, chests, breasts, groins, shoulders, toes, buttocks, goiters and scrotums, an undrawable bone cage, a flesh loom, a game of twister with several Siamese bodies pulled apart and smooshed together. Up here's Angelica's head, with her matted indigo hair and a tongue stud showing. Down there's Axel's head. In the core, I see their pneumatic sexes, swollen, huge, and crimson raw like a Francis Bacon porn mare. The stink of bad fish is nauseating, and the Axel head grins at me through the slit in the drape, through my Miss Piggy eyehole, and he speaks, but his words are jolted out of him in Angelica's voice. "Is, oink, oink, hungry for a bacon sandwich," and the Angelica head, melded onto a flabby thigh with wrists where its ears should be, grunts back in Axel's voice, "Don't be mean. Sally hates it when we call her that." I skitter back across the floor to the panelled door and slam it behind me, quivering with disgust, with horror, with... The grandfather clock is calm and collected. Far, far below, the black and white tiled hallway is quiet. Up above, the pale doors waiting. It's a bad acid trip. I've heard about them. Piers, my first non-boyfriend, had one once and it sounded like this. Axel and Angelica were having sex, but I saw it through kaleidoscopic drug-tinted spectacles. I need to get Todd urgently so he can keep an eye on me. I walk up the stairs, past two portraits, one of a young rockabilly type with brill-creamed hair and half-open shirt, the next a woman with eyeliner like Cleopatra and a beehive Martha and the Vandellas hairdo. The next portrait, however, stops me dead. It's of a boy in school uniform, and I've seen him once already tonight. I get out Axel's A4 sheet from my jacket and compare them. It's Nathan Bishop. My feet take me up to the next portrait, which shows Mr. Dressing Gown from earlier. Now that Axel's case study is in front of me, I can name him Gordon Edmonds, who I spoke to on the cold sofa a little while ago, or who I dreamed I spoke to. I don't know which. I don't even know if I'm that shocked to find Sally Tim staring out of the final picture, standing in her ZZ Hikaru jacket with Freya's Maori pendant round her neck, the same image they used on TV. Except my eyes are now two freakish blanks, and she's frowning, as if I can't understand why I can't see anymore. And as I watch, one of her index fingers rises to tap the inside face of the canvas. I half-half, half-shriek, half-slip, half-fall onto the ledge at the very top of the stairs, and my hand steadies me by shooting up and grasping the shiny doorknob on the pale door, which swings open, and suddenly Todd's there, looking at me, bloodless and thunderstruck. I say, "Todd!" And he jumps back. And I realize it's my mask, so I yank it off and say his name again, and Todd says, "Sal, Sal, thank Christ I found you." And now we're hugging. Todd's bony and skinny, but his muscles are iron, though he's really cold, like he's just walked in from a frosty night. Behind him is the sloping ceiling of a dark attic. Todd uncouples himself from our hug and shuts the pale door. "Something bad's happening in this house, Sal. We need to get out." We're both whispering. "Yes, I know. Someone spiked our drinks. I'm seeing impossible things. Like, where do I begin? Todd, the TV said I've been missing for 5 days. Missing. I can't be. And look." I point at my eyeless portrait, which has stopped moving now. "It's me. That picture's me. Wearing this." I hold up the real necklace for Todd to see, which I only got today. It's insane. Todd swallows. "I'm afraid it's worse than an acid trip, Sal." I see he's serious. I fumble at what it means. "What then?" "We joined Parasoc for paranormal experiences. We found them, and they're not benign. They'll try to stop us getting out." "I'm afraid to ask. Who tried to stop us?" Todd glances behind us at the pale door. "Our hosts, the twins. I put them to sleep, but they'll wake up soon, angry and hungry."
"Twins? What twins? What do they want?"
Todd says it low and level.
"To consume your soul."
I wait for him to tell me he's joking. I wait. I wait. Todd's holding my elbows.
"Slade House is their life support machine, Sal, but it's powered by souls. And not just any old souls. It's like blood groups. The type they need is very rare. And your soul is that very rare type. We have to get you out. Now. We'll go down the stairs, out via the kitchen, across the garden. And once we're in Slade Alley, I think we'll be safe. Safer, anyway."
I feel Todd's breath on my forehead.
I saw some big gates onto Cranberry Avenue and another black iron door in the hall.
Todd shakes his head. That's wallpaper to fool you. The one way out is the one way in, the aperture.
What about Fern, Lance, Axel, Angelica?
A muscle in Todd's cheek twitches. They're beyond my help.
What do you mean? What'll happen to them?
Todd hesitates. You're the fruit. They're the pith, stone and skin. They've been discarded.
But I point down the stairs. Are there more stairs now?
To the square landing, but the door into the igloo room has gone.
I saw Axel and Angelica down there, sort of.
You saw fleshy 3D Polaroids of Axel and Angelica, which wouldn't stand much scrutiny close up. Listen, Todd grips my hand. Carefully. On our way out, speak to nobody. Respond to nobody. Meet nobody's eye. Accept nothing. Eat nothing. Drink nothing. This version of Slade House is a shadow play, evoked into being. If you engage with it, the twins sense you. They'll wake. They'll extract your soul. Understand?
Kind of. Yes. No. Who are you?
I'm a kind of bodyguard. Look, I'll explain back at my parents' house. We have to go, Sal, or it'll be too late. Remember, vow of silence. Eyes down. Don't let go of my hand. I'll cloak us as best I can. Put that mask back on, too. It may sow a little extra confusion.
Todd holds my hot hand in his cold one, and I focus on my feet to avoid looking at portraits. Time passes. Steps fly under our feet, and we arrive at the grandfather clock. Its crunk-crunks are all tempos all at once. The panelled door to the igloo room hasn't reappeared.
There was a door here, I whisper. Did I dream it?
Todd murmurs,
rats in a maze of movable walls ask themselves the same thing.
Halfway down the lower flight of stairs, students start appearing in the hallway, chatting, arguing, smoking, flirting. The volume rises with every step.
So you found him,
says the Tin Man girl with a smile, pressing a black drink against her silver cheek.
I'm Urvashi. What's your name?
Todd squeezes my hand to warn me against answering. It's like the don't say yes or no game Dad used to play with me and Freya on car journeys, but here you mustn't be tricked into saying anything at all. Urvashi the Tin Man's in my face.
Oi, Miss Piggy! Answer or you'll be Miss Piggy for the rest of forever. Hey!
But Todd pulls me on, and Urvashi's lost in a blur of faces, masks, bodies, and soon we're back in the kitchen. Caught by the fuzz, by Supergrass is pumping out of a stereo. Todd leads me around the edge, and it's going well until we pass within inches of Todd Cosgrove and Sally Timms, huddled in a corner by an oven with a noisy fan. I stop. Fake Todd's drinking Indian beer from a bottle, and fake me's drinking shit red wine from a plastic cup. Fake Todd saying, "Your sister's older than you, I'm guessing," and fake Sally nods, "Was it a 50-50 guess, or can you really tell?" I hear Todd, real Todd, inside my ear canal, telling me, "Keep going, Sal. They're flypaper." He propels me on, his arm round my waist, past a table of bottles, cans, a punch bowl, and two Wedgwood cake stands full of brownies. We go under an archway into a utility room, with a dozen people between us and the door, including a dug-up corpse, an unravelling mummy, a tube of Colgate toothpaste with a red bucket for a cap, and Lance Arnott, who blocks my way, looking like a lost soul in an old painting of hell.
There's something evil in here.
It's not him, says Todd in my inner ear, but Lance is gripping my lapels. It is him. I smell his yeasty B.O.
Please, Sal. I know I was an asshole, but please don't leave me, please.
Okay, okay, I whisper. We'll take you with us. Instantly, Lance's face dribbles off, revealing something bonier, hungrier and toothier beneath. I try to scream, but my throat's locked. Todd steps between us and traces signs onto the air. I half see the living black lines he inscribes before they vanish, and then the thing who wore the Lance Arnott disguise flickers off and on and off, and is gone. I gasp, what the f... I unplug the modem. Todd tells me, telepathically, I notice a moment later, and instantly accept. But the twins are waking. The kitchen's silent. My heart's drumming, and a vein in my neck's twitching in time. Some of the partygoers are turning our way, sensing that we don't belong. Act normally, says Todd's voice. Don't show fear. And he leads me to the back door. Locked. Not showing fear's one thing, but I feel it. It's slithering around my body, just under my skin. Todd makes a threading motion with his fingers, and the door opens. He bundles us through. I'll lock them in behind us, Todd tells me, and turns to trace a symbol at the door. It's dark out. Down the garden, I make out the Slade Alley wall behind the shrubbery, just. Fern Panhaligan appears, looking delighted.
Sal, you left this on the sofa. Catch!
She tosses me my Tiffany compact, the gift from Freya, and I catch it. Dark fireworks zigzagged over marbled skies. The zigzags plucked at harpsichord wires, and I floated on the Dead Sea and could have stayed there forever. But a wave of pain lifted me up, high as spires, then hurled me down hard onto the pebbles at the foot of Slade House. Todd's scared face appears up close. Sal, can you hear me? Sal! My skin pops like bubble wrap, and I grunt a yes. The orison's imploding. Can you walk? Before I can answer, Todd hauls me upright and my legs are heavy and bendy, and I step on something snappable. My Tiffany mirror. And we stagger across the upper lawn. We reach a wisteria trellis, where a creeping shockwave catches us and bowls us over a cropped lawn covered with tiny fan-shaped leaves. I want to lie there forever, but Todd drags me up again, and Slade House by night's shimmering, fat and thin, reflected or refracted. Then figures come strolling through the shimmer. Rows and clusters of figures, ambling like they know they don't have to hurry. Their bodies are blurs, but there's Axel's face. There's Angelica, everyone in my Chaucer seminar, my teachers from Great Malvern, Isolde Delahunty and her Barbies, Mum, Dad, Freya. Todd pulls me. Run, Sal! And we try. God, we try, but it's like running through water. Rose thorns scratch my eyes, a bucking path trips us, damson trees claw us, and a shrubbery billows up, and its roots try to hook our ankles. But here's the small black iron door. Stupidly, I look back, like you never should in stories. The figures flicker nearer. There's Piers, who said his night with Oink had been like shagging a dead blubber whale on a beach, only smellier. Todd's saying to me, you have to open the aperture, Sal. He means the black iron door. How? What do I do? Open it, like you did before. I can't do it. The faceless walkers are closing in. I'm shaking. What did I do before? You pressed it with your palm. So I press the small black iron door, and it presses back just as hard. Why isn't it working? You're too scared. It's blocking your voltage. I look behind us, yards away. They've got us. Todd begs. Forget the fear, Sal, please. I can't. You can. I can't. Todd presses his hands against my cheeks and gently, firmly, kisses my lips and whispers, Please, Sal. I'm still scared, but something's unlocked and something flows through my hand. The door swings open and Todd's pushing me through into... a starless, bodiless, painless, timeless blackness. I don't know how long I've been here. Minutes? Years? I just don't know. I passed through a phase when I thought I must be dead, but my mind's alive, even if I can't tell if I'm in my body or not. I prayed to God for help, or just for a light, apologizing for not believing in him, and trying hard not to think about what a sociopathic bigot he is in the Old Testament and the Book of Revelation, but no reply came. I thought about Freya and Mum and Dad, and tried and failed to remember the last things I'd said to them. I thought about Todd. If he'd survived, he'd be helping the police look for me, even though I doubted this was a place where sniffer dogs could track you. I hoped Todd wasn't angry at me for interacting with fake Fern and catching the mirror. Was that a fatal mistake? Like Orpheus looking back? A dirty trick, if so. My hands just acted on reflex to save my mirror. But legends and stories are as full of dirty tricks as life is, and however much time has gone by, nothing has changed, and all I have are memories, the brightest of them all being Todd's hurried kiss, to keep me company and to keep me sane in the starless, bodiless, painless, timeless blackness. After minutes or months, a dim dot of light appears. I was afraid I'd gone blind, like Todd's mum. Seconds or years later, the dot grows into a slit of flame, the flame of a candle on a strange candlestick that sits in front of me on the bare floorboards. The flame's absolutely still. It's not bright enough to reveal much of the room. An attic? But by its light I see three faces. To my right sits Kate Childs, the Wicked Witch of the West, dressed in a grey Arab-style cloak thing, but now in her mid-30s. Have I really been here so long? Have all those years been stolen from me? To my left hovers another vaguely familiar face. Jesus, it's Melbourne Mike. He's now the same age as the older Kate Childs too, also motionless and Buddha-posed, and also wearing an ash-grey robe. Now I see them both in the same field of vision, I realize they're twins. The third face is Miss Piggy, watching me over the candle, about 6 paces dead ahead, or rather, a kneeling girl in a Miss Piggy mask, a girl wearing a Zizi Hikaru jacket, with a Maori pendant round her chubby neck. Me, or my reflection. I try to move, speak, or even grunt, but my body won't respond. My brain works. My eyes work. That's about it. Like that Frenchman in the book Freya sent me, the diving bell and the butterfly. Locked-in syndrome, it's called. But the French guy could blink one eyelid. That's how he managed to communicate. I can't even do that. Left of the mirror is a pale door with a gold doorknob. A memory of that same door from an earlier time drags itself into focus. The room at the top of Slade House. The games room. Have the three of us been drugged and brought here? Who by? And where's Todd?
The Cosgrove boy's been let go, with the other waifs and strays you brought in with you, Kate Childs says.
The candle flame quivers, her American accent's gone, replaced by crisp upper-class English, not unlike my mother's.
You're here in Slade House, at my and my brother's behest. I'm Nora, and this is Jonah.
I tried to ask, what do you mean, the Cosgrove boy's been let go, but my mouth isn't working, not even a little bit.
Dead. He didn't suffer. Don't mourn. He never loved you. Over the last few weeks, culminating in tonight's show, he was my brother's ventriloquist's dummy, mouthing all those lovey-dovey lies you yearned so badly to hear.
I try to tell this Nora she's insane, that I know Todd loves me.
You tell her, Nora orders Melbourne Mike, or Jonah, irritably, or she'll taste all saccharine and powdery. Jonah, if that's his actual name, sneers my way.
It's all true, sweetie. Every word.
His Australian accent's gone. He has a plummy public school voice.
I was inside Todd Cosgrove's head, and I promise you, he found Sally Timms as erotic as a tub of lard forgotten at the back of the fridge.
You're lying. Todd kissed me. Todd tried to help me escape.
Let me translate it into stupidest oink oink. Everything from the pub to the aperture in Slade Alley was real. This attic is real too, and these are our real bodies. Between the iron door and waking up here, however, was an orison, a live 3D stage set projected from inside this lacuna in time.
Jonah drums on the floorboards.
By my outrageously gifted sister. A scripted vision. I was in it too. Or, strictly speaking, my soul was there, moving Todd's body, saying Todd's lines. But everything else, the people you met, the rooms you passed through, the taste you tasted, was a local reality brought into being by my sister. Your and Todd's thrilling bid for freedom was another part of the rat's maze we had you run through. An orison inside an orison. A sub-orison. We need a better name for it, I agree. I'd ask you to help us to think of one, but you're dying.
My stubborn me insists. You're lying. This is all a bad acid trip.
No.
Jonah sounds pleased.
You're really dying. You're a respiratory system. No muscles. Think about it. Is that the bad acid trip too?
To my horror, I realize he's right. My lungs aren't working. I can't gasp, or fall over, or do anything but kneel here and slowly suffocate. The twins now appear to lose interest in me.
I am speechless with admiration, sister,
Jonah's saying.
You haven't been speechless for 100 years.
Says Nora.
If the Academy awarded Oscars for Best Orison, you'd be a shoo-in. Truly, it was a masterpiece. Cubist, postmodern, superlatives fail me.
Yes, yes, yes. We're geniuses. But what about the policeman? His residue was substantial enough to speak with the guest. And the aperture, appearing of its own accord like that, and open. The girl nearly bolted.
Ah, but she didn't bolt. And why? Cupid's noose was firmly round her neck, is why. Todd Cosgrove was a trickier role to pull off than Chloe Chetwynd, you'll concede. Plod would have mounted a gashed slab of raw liver, while this little piggy needed proper wooing.
These words would normally draw blood. But right now I'm worrying about how long you can survive without oxygen. 3 minutes? Nora Greyer twists her head as if screwing it into a socket.
As per usual, brother,
you're missing the point. With each open day, these aberrations grow worse. Jonah flexes his spidery fingers.
As per usual, sister, you're spouting paranoid nonsense. Once again... Dinner is served without hitch or hiccup. Once again, our operandi is charged for a full cycle. Personally, I blame your sojourn in Hollywood for these histrionics. Too many actors' hairy buttocks in too many mirrored ceilings.
She half whispers, half growls.
It really isn't in your best interests to speak to me like that, brother. Oh? Will you take another unannounced sabbatical to the Chilean Andes to divine the meaning of metalife? Go, by all means. Do you good. Inhabit some Indian peasant. Or an alpaca. I'll drive you to the airport after dinner. You'll be back. The operandi's bigger than both of us, baby.
The operandi's 60 years old. To cut ourselves off, from the shaded way,
avoids unwanted attention from the only people alive who could cause us trouble. We're demigods, enthrall to no one. Can we please keep it that way?
We're enthrall to this risible pantomime every 9 years, replies Nora acidly. We're enthrall to these. She indicates her body with disgust. Birth bodies, to anchor our souls in the world of day. We're enthrall to luck, ensuring that nothing goes wrong.
I'm still not breathing, and I feel like my skull's starting to contract. Desperately, fiercely, I think the word help.
Can we please dine now? Asks Jonah. Unless you plan to kill the operandi in a fit of pique.
My skull throbs painfully as my body groans for air. Please, I can't breathe. Nora exhales like a moody adolescent and grudgingly nods. The Greyer twins' hands then begin to weave through the air like Todd Cosgrove's did earlier, leaving short-lived scratch marks on the dark air. Their lips move and a murmur grows louder as something solidifies above the candle, cell by cell, a kind of fleshy jellyfish pulsing with reds and purples. It would be pretty if it weren't something from an alien horror movie. Tendrils grow out of it. Tendrils with sub-tendrils. Some of them twist through the air towards me, and one pauses for a moment, an inch from my eye. I see a tiny orifice at its tip, opening and closing like a carp, before it plunges up my left nostril. Luckily, I barely feel it, or the others, as they worm into my mouth, up my right nostril, and into my ears, though I feel a sudden drill bit of pain in my forehead and see, in the mirror opposite, a shimmering something oozing through one of my mask's eye holes. It gathers in a small clear sphere in front of my eyes. Tiny, luminous plankton hover inside it. So, souls are real, it seems. My souls, the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. But now, the Greyer twins close in on both sides. No, you can't. It's mine. Please. No, no, no. They purse their lips like they're about to whistle. Help, help, help. Freya, Freya. Anyone. Help, help. I need. The twins inhale, stretching my soul into an oval. Someone will stop you one day and you'll suffer, you'll pay. My soul splits in two. Nora inhales one half, Jonah the other. Their faces look like Piers's did that night in Malvern. And now it's over. They're sitting back where they were. The tendril things have gone. The glowing lump has gone. The Greyers are as still as sculptures. So is the candle flame. In the mirror, a Miss Piggy mask slaps the floor.
You dark horse, you. 2006. I nodded off for long enough to slip into a stressful dream. I dreamed I got cold feet about meeting Fred Pink here this evening. Halfway across the cold park, I turned back, but a black and orange jogger sprayed a blast into my face from an asthma inhaler. Then I saw a woman in a wheelchair being pushed by Tom Cruise. Her face was hidden by a raincoat hood, and Tom Cruise said, "Go right ahead, take a look." So I lifted the hood and saw she was me. Then we were traveling down a narrow alley, and someone said, "You pay an army for 1,000 days to use it on one." Last of all was a black slab like the black slabs in 2001 A Space Odyssey, and as it opened, I heard Sally saying, "You have to wake up." So I did, and here I am, alone, in the upstairs room at the Fox and Hounds, as arranged. It's seedier than how I remember it from 1997. The tables are scarred. The chairs are rickety, the wallpaper's scraggy, and the carpet's the colour of dried vomit. My tomato juice sits in a smeary glass. Liquefied roadkill. The Fox and Hound is on its last legs, clearly. Downstairs there are only 6 drinkers at the bar, and one of them is a dog for the blind, and on a Saturday evening.
The sole nod to Alcofrolic Jollity is an old-time enameled Guinness ad, screwed to the wall over the blocked-up fireplace, with a leprechaun playing a fiddle for a dancing toucan. I wonder if that leprechaun noticed Sally 9 years ago, and if she noticed him. They sat up here, the X-Files six. Several witnesses saw my sister and her friends, but nobody agreed at which table they had been sitting. I press my forehead against the dirty window pane. In the street below, Fred Pink still having his quick catch-up with Mrs. Benson and Hedges. The street lights are coming on. The sun sinks into tarmac grey clouds, over one-way mazes of brick houses, gas works, muddy canals, old factories, unloved blocks of flats from the 60s, multi-story car parks from the 70s, tatty-looking housing from the 80s, a neon-edged multiplex from the 90s, cul-de-sacs, ring roads, bus lanes, flyovers. I wish Sally's last known place of abode could have been prettier. For the millionth time, I wonder if she's still alive, locked in a madman's attic, praying that we'll never give up, never stop looking. Always, I wonder. Sometimes, I envy the weeping parents of the definitely dead you see on TV. Grief is an amputation, but hope is incurable haemophilia. You bleed and bleed and bleed, like Schrodinger's cat inside a box you can never ever open. For the millionth time, I flinch about wriggling out of inviting my sister to New York the summer before she started uni here. Sally wanted to visit, I knew, but I had a job at a photo agency, fashionista friends, invitations to private views, and I was just starting to date women. It was an odd time. Discovering my real me and babysitting my tubby, dorky, nervy sister had just felt all too much. So I told Sal some bullshit about finding my feet. She pretended to believe me, and I'll never forgive myself. Avril says that not even God can change the past. She's right, but it doesn't help. I get out my mobile and text Avril. At pub. Real dive. FP no nutter so far, but we'll see. Interview begins in a mo. Home when I can. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Send. Avril will be heating up yesterday's lasagna, opening a bottle of wine, settling down to an episode or three of The Wire. Wish I was with her. I've known livelier morgues than the Fox and Hounds. The whiskery landlady downstairs tried to crack a funny when we came in. Evening, dearie. You must be our Fred's latest girlfriend, then. Fred, you dark horse, you. What magazine you order this one out of, eh? I should have said, Hot Ukrainian Dykes Weekly. When the landlady learned I'm a journalist with an interest in Slade Alley, she turned frosty, and her dearie grew thorns. That's the media for you, isn't it? Why let a sleeping dog lie when you can flog a dead horse, eh, dearie, eh? Footsteps clomp up the stairs. I get out my Sony digital recorder, a gift from Dad and Sook, a.k.a. Mrs. John Timms III, and put it on the table. In walks Fred Pink, a withered grey man in a tatty brown coat and a schoolboy's leather satchel that must be half a century old.
Sorry to keep you, Miss Timms. I do need my little fix.
He's got a gruff, friendly voice you want to trust. No problem, I say. Will this table do?
Best seat in the house.
He puts his beer on the table, sits down like the old man he is, and rubs his skin and bone hands. His face is pocked, saggy and spiky with bristles. His glasses are fixed with duct tape.
Bloomin' parky out. This smoking ban'll be the death of us, I tell you. If cancer don't get us, the double pneumonia will. Still can't get my head round not smoking. In a pub. Political correctness gone mad, that's what it is. Ever interview Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or that lot, do you, in your line of work?
Only in press packs. You have to be at the top of the food chain for a private audience. Mr. Pink, could I record our interview? That way I can concentrate on what you're saying without taking notes.
Record away.